So I got those Where's Wally books.
Yeah, the impulse didn't float away before you acted on it.
No, they were gotten, I believe, before the podcast had even finished last week. Yeah, I got a Ziploc bag on eBay. It was just a Ziploc bag full of Where's Wally books. Possibly all of them, I don't know. But, like, I've got all the main ones that I remember, then a whole bunch of the activity books. That's it.
Yeah.
What can I tell you about them? I was going to get them before we recorded, right? I was going to go, well, I bought these and I'm going to talk about them. I'll grab them and bring them over. But it's not like there's any, like, fun text I could read you.
Well, how's about this? You pick a random page and you start describing people and we stop you with one of them. Sounds like it's Wally. Oh, sorry, Waldo for any Americans listening.
I have been wondering.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
No, I know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's the other thing, because I was going to also talk about the Wally-Waldo discrepancy. Oh, by the way, it should point out that despite being super-duper busy and desperately needing to sort of get here quickly and get this done, knocked out so I can get back to work, right?
Right.
I did sit and watch the entirety of the Where's Wally cartoon intro before I came in here because I was like, I better get that out of the way.
Sure.
Otherwise, it would be, I say it would be stuck in my head, but as I talk, I've just got, oh, where's Wally? And now, oh, where's Wally? Like, stuck in my head. Oh, there he is. Yes. So,
well,
yeah, the other interesting the answer, thing.
Well, I was, sorry. Go ahead.
No, because I've got a bit of a, it's a bit of a story, so.
Oh, okay. I was purely going to chime in with regarding the discrepancy between Where's Wally and Where's Waldo. If you call it Where's Waldo, you are incorrect. It's a British series. Originally, it's Where's Wally. You apparently couldn't handle a man called Wally.
There we go.
But you see, post-revolution, everything that was British that had value inherently gets stolen by Americans and made more popular. So,
yeah, that's
what
true.
Can you do?
That's interesting you say that, because the thing I want to talk about involves the discrepancy between Wally and Waldo and how that confused me as it pertains to the antagonist of the Where's Wally series, Oddlaw, which, as a kid, I didn't know what the fuck that meant. As a kid, I'm watching the Where's Wally cartoon, and for some reason, I didn't remember him in the books. I thought he was a new introduction, even though he's in the first one.
I don't remember him from the books at all.
Oh.
Like, the name is vaguely familiar.
Yeah.
But
he's like the Wario version of Wally. He's got a black and yellow striped jumper with, yeah, his scheme's all black and yellow, and he kind of looks similar, except he's got like this dirty little moustache. And that's Waldo. And he was sort of a proper bad guy in the cartoon. In the books, he's just another guy you find. In the cartoon, proper bad guy. And that's where I remember him from. And they're all calling him Oddlaw. And as a kid, the best I could come up with was, it was a cartoon. They didn't want to outright say the word outlaw. So they thought his behavior, while not strictly criminal, does go against the spirit of the law of the land.
When in reality, it was just that they'd spelled Waldo backwards.
Yeah, like Waldo backwards. But I was a British kid growing up in Britain. I didn't know he was called Waldo until like the internet was invented.
Well, this is where it gets confusing, because he's called Oddlaw in the British books.
In the British books, he's not called Illow.
Yeah, and also to further complicate things, he's got a British accent in the cartoon.
Unbelievable.
As if he was a reverse of the British character Wally.
That's,
but he's not, he's Waldo, so he should be American.
The American has the British name, and the Brit has the American. It's so confusing. Do you think he had book rights, the guy that did the books, in America, and they'd already been like, we're going to call it Waldo over here. And then he was like, Illow is a stupid name for a villain. I'm going to go with Oddlaw. And the British kids are just going to have to make their own weird canon up.
I'd always just assumed Americans couldn't handle a character whose name was kind of close to Willy.
Which would be funny, considering Willy isn't really a rude term over there. And Hey Arnold, the theme park in Hey Arnold was called Wanky Land. And I'm almost certain they did know what they were doing.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, there is an episode of Hey Arnold where everyone's just repeating the word Wanky Land, which sounds like heaven.
Mm-hmm.
I want to live in Wanky Land.
I do.
Yeah.
Who doesn't?
Oh, dear. Do you remember that old YouTube video? Well, it was pre-YouTube, the old claymation about the guy that does a shit and then wanks onto it and then summons the wanky shit demon.
I must have missed that.
Oh, God, you have unlocked a thing in my head.
I'm the wanky
shit demon.
That
I didn't realise I knew.
You can wish for anything, so long as it's made of shit or wank. Good times. Good times. I believe that's pretty much everything I've got on the docket. I was going to do a bit about finding a no-sided love heart, but that was the entire story I found. Mm. I was eating a packet of love hearts, which are some of the best sweets in the world. And for those who don't know, they have little hearts printed on them with little words in them. Like, you know, or you know, little phrases, I love you, or hot stuff. Like,
yeah, we call them sweethearts here.
Yeah,
they're generally,
and that's it.
Yeah, they're generally only available around Valentine's Day, and
they're
chalky.
Sherbet chalk.
Yeah.
They're fucking great, is what they are. But yeah, sherbet chalk, basically.
I'm not a fan.
No?
It's more about the expressions. You know, you want to talk about... So this is great. This past year for Valentine's Day, they sold misprints.
Oh, on purpose?
Yeah, they sold slightly fucked up misprints, which I fucking love. I love
That's
that they
funny.
Found another way to squeeze more money out of the holiday.
Why not? Why not? I don't know if you had an alternative in America, but I don't know, Laura, if you remember Jibes, the edgy alternative to Love Hearts. It was very short run. I think this was like the 90s. That was probably the peak of... stuff is for boys and stuff is for girls.
Mm. Oh, yeah, these are the ones where, like, rather than being, like, a lovey-dovey message, it's like, oh, wimp.
Yeah, like, wimp.
Jerk.
Bog off. Yeah, just
smelly
insults.
Head.
Really tame milquetoast insults. Tame and milquetoast would have been a good jibe. And instead of, like, a heart shape, they were in a speech bubble. And I got them and I loved them because they were just love heart, which I never really considered... indicative of my 9-year-old masculinity. So I just kept getting them. I wasn't ashamed. I'm not ashamed. Listeners have eaten love hearts or jibes. It's all chalky sherbet as far as this cat's concerned. The no-sided love heart was followed by a love heart that had sorry printed on it, and I found that quite fun. And now I've said
funny. Everything
I intend to say for the rest of time.
Well, I'll have to take the reins then and tell people this is Pogquisition. We talk about video games sometimes here.
You absolutely will.
Stuff.
God damn it, why did I already break the fucking veil of silence? Oh, well.
Well, now that it's broken, you're just going to have to talk about some video games, probably. How many things have people played this week? Who's played stuff?
I played 2 games and I watched the same show you did.
I played 1 game that you did and didn't watch the show, and am very angry about how I haven't had time to watch the show.
Should we get the show out the way in spoiler-light terms so we don't ruin anything for Conrad?
Why not? And yes, very spoiler-light. We'll just give, we'll give opinion.
Yeah, we watched that Fallout show.
We did. We watched the Fallout show. Mifi and Echo, we all watched it here, and we're really glued to it. Like, I put on one episode, and I just intended to watch the pilot, but we ended up, like, going through it in 2 days. I really liked it. I found it very well written. I found it, like, better written than any of the Bethesda's games, at least. Had a bit of a Game of Thronesy sort of quality to it in the way the plots were intertwining and stuff.
Mm.
Really thought the characters were fun. I laughed out loud quite a few times.
Yeah.
The line about the chickens, that the whole everything to do with that particular character was so good. Your intestines might fall the fuck out. It's so good.
It was pretty impressive, because the thing I kept thinking about is, for a series that is so quintessentially about one person on a very lone trek through the end of the world, They did a really good job of making that into an ensemble story.
Oh, see, I don't see it as that. I've never seen Fallout as, like, yes, the plot is about one guy, but the game is about the setting. It's about the people who populate it.
I think that the show absolutely nails being about the setting as well.
Yeah, that's what I've
like,
heard.
So much of what it is about is contrasting what the vaults are like versus what the wasteland is like and what that kind of world can do to a person. So they really go, again, they go in on it more than the games.
Yeah, they do a very good job of being like, we're going to give you a lot of time to really breathe in different settings and perspectives on an interconnected set of spaces, but ultimately like one kind of story. And they did such a good job of like really fleshing out a lot of the breadth of what living in that world sort of entails.
Yeah. And it was pointed out, I think they first noticed it, is all of the kickoff, various kickoffs with characters for the plot, is all the start of the games. Like,
yeah,
the start of each game is sort of represented in those storylines, except for the very first game, the beginning of which is represented brilliantly. That's the other thing, is like, unlike a lot of these things, it is not packed full of references and constant in-jokes. It's just another story in the Fallout universe. I would be very happy, actually, if this was considered canon in the Fallout universe.
My understanding is it is.
I'm happy with
that. The intention is for it to take place in canon. I believe it takes place like 20 or 30 years after the current, all of the games that currently exist, then 20 or 30 years later this happens.
Ah.
Yeah, they do a good job of, they're not trying to adapt one particular story, and they're not doing too much of the, hey, it's that thing you know.
Yeah.
They indulge maybe one big example of that toward the end of here's that thing.
Oh, I mean, I'll tell you what, like, I mean, I think they earned that, the big sort of, the big fanboy moment, because they were so restrained. What surprised me was watching it, they've held back on so many iconic things for presumably, you know, the next season and stuff. And I respect that.
Yeah.
I respect that we weren't drowning in like iconic monsters and enemies and places. They have been measured and restrained, and it carries with it a confidence in its own writing and characters that it doesn't need that shit.
I think one of the things that it does really well is it uses the concept that, like, all of the vaults in the Fallout universe are all very disparate in how they are run and what their purpose is and the societies that they end up creating.
Yeah.
And they really get that that's a good playground for, we can just do our own little micro things because of those little subcultures that grow out of locking a bunch of people in a place away from the rest of society for a while.
Oh my god, like, in portraying, like, the heartlessness of the corporations in Fallout's universe, again, I think more than any other game or piece of lore, that show has effectively, like, portrayed what a piece of shit Vault-Tec is. Like, vile, like skin-crawling. It's uncomfortable, the level of, like, the lack of humanity shown sometimes. Even more so knowing that they're just reflecting how these people, like, the real-life alternatives think.
Yeah.
It's great. Really good.
It is genuinely, it's a very fun show. It's pretty well-paced. It, like, it keeps itself going. It doesn't get too bogged down in its main plot. It has room to go on little silly little side quests. And for all of the, like, at times it gets a little, like, we're just gonna throw blood at the walls, a little chaos-y. It's always so exaggerated that it's always very, I can't take this too seriously because it looks like you threw ragu up the wall when you blew someone's brains out.
Oh, yeah, like,
and I'm like, yeah.
There is times where, like, I made a joke at one point about, like, the ghoul having the ludicrous jibs perk. But I do think that is deliberate. I do think they are, like, because it is mostly when the ghoul shoots someone, they fucking explode. And I know, like, part of it is the gun he's got. But it is the ludicrous jibs perk.
Yeah, honestly, really, really pleasantly surprised with it.
Yeah, it's so impressive. The fact that it is just a story in the Fallout universe and it slots so well. Maybe a few things, like a few little snarls, but the general thrust of it just slots right in.
Yeah. It walks the line between if you know Fallout stuff already, you're getting something new, while if you don't know Fallout at all, it's giving you enough of the background to get invested.
Oh, yeah.
Without feeling like it's treading water for people who know what's going on. They balance that so well.
Yeah. To newcomers, it's just a story about how fucking shit a post-apocalyptic wasteland would really be, which is great. And then, of course, you've got all the little Fallout-y bits for everyone else, which, again, they're not leaning, they're not relying on it. They're throwing bits in for fun, and they're earning those bits. And they know they don't need it. They don't, because I was watching each new episode not to see what great Fallout reference would be next, but where the fucking story was going. The story hooks are so good that when an episode ended and it was 2 a.m. and I wanted to go to bed, I was like, fuck, there's 2 episodes left and I need to see where it's going. Plus, it's got Kyle MacLachlan in it. And
Kyle MacLachlan's
in it, and he's great. And Walton Goggins is in it as the ghoul. And I am a huge fan of Walton Goggins. I think he's great. I started rewatching Vice Principals after Fallout just to see his performance. And he's great in this as well.
Yeah, I was so delighted to see Kyle MacLachlan. I love a good bit of Kyle MacLachlan and stuff. Yes.
What a good show, yeah.
It's real good. It's well worth watching. I want to talk about a video game I played this week. That's all right. I got one
I
of them.
Know. You know what? Yeah. Yeah, go on. Yeah. Treat yourself.
Yeah. So I've started playing Life Eater, which is the new game from the person behind El Paso Elsewhere.
Oh.
Yeah. So they've got a new game out, and the best couple of word description I can give you for it is spreadsheet management serial killer simulator. The gist of it is you are playing as some guy in deep South America, your sort of trucker hat wearing, sleeveless shirt, kind of American flag waving type of guy, who one day about 20 years ago, he met God. God reached out to him and he's like, hey, I'm Zimforth. The world will end if you do not sacrifice in ritual murder to me once a year. I'm going to get a bit particular. I want it done a certain way. Sometimes I'll give you vague hints about who needs killing. And the world will literally end if you do not go do murders for me. I am Zimforth.
Oh.
Don't test me. So it is a game of a man spending 20 years just in between he just lives his life. And about once a year, Zimforth will send a message down and go, hey, this year, I want someone who won't be missed. Find them. Go do a kill on them. But for a game that is theoretically about serial ritual murder for evil god, it is a very not gory... It's a very mundane game. Because the gameplay itself is largely kind of spreadsheet management.
Mm.
So you have a list of things that you will always need to work out about your targets in order to complete the ritual for Zimforth correctly. It'll be things like, does your target sleep less than 6 hours per night? If so, break the third rib. Do they have black hair? Break rib 11. If not, remove the left lung. There's a little list of things like this that you've got to, you've got to learn the things about your target. And the way that you do that is that you have essentially a week of their life in little blocks, and it looks like a video editor. And you're clicking on clips in the video editor and basically making the decision between, do you want to spend more time trying to uncover this block of what that person's doing with their week in that block of time, or do you want to risk being noticed? You've got a balancing act of, you've got a certain amount of time and a certain amount of suspicion that can grow on you, otherwise you'll fail. So you're trying to balance, oh, maybe I'll knock on the door and run away. That's a quick thing I can do, but it will be suspicious. Or maybe I can do installing a keylogger on their computer. It's going to take a lot of time, but they, maybe won't be so suspicious. To uncover these chunks of what their week is, to answer these questions, do they have a commute to work? Do they take more than 2 bathroom breaks a day? Do they have children? Do they live alone? Until you have enough evidence to go, I'm going to do that kill, and be able to do the ritual to do with it correctly. And as you go through, none of the things you have to do in the ritual change. Like, the list of things you have to find out about a person is pretty consistent, but you are having to have slightly more complicated situations where it's like, okay, here's like one of three suspected people. Not only are you trying to find out all the stuff for the ritual, but you've got to work out which of these three people doesn't have a job and is considered slothful by Zimforth. And you've still only got the certain amount of times you're having to, like, be very strategic about which blocks of time you unlock to try and as quickly as possible rule people out as not the target you're looking for in order to do these ritual killings to stave off the end of the world for another year.
I am so excited by this premise, and I feel like I saw it somewhere or someone mentioned it, because the name and like the sacrificing element is somewhat familiar. That part of it was an idea that I was seriously thinking about trying to develop into like a series of a short series of tabletop for Dice Funk, centered around that, you know, kind of, you know, every year sacrifice of the community type thing. But the other thing, and this blows my mind, because that process of elimination, determining who the person, about, I don't know, 10 or so years ago, I wanted to start work on like an office drama where you are contacted by a, you know, some kind of future organization that's like, hey, one of these people that you're working with has been replaced by a robot. And you have to figure out who it is before they can perform their assassination mission and change the future. And it was a similar sort of, you know, working in the office, talking to people to figure out who meets the criteria to be a robot. And so this is, in essence, that same idea. And so I'm really keen to play it, since I don't have to make it.
Yes, and the comparisons to, like, office drama, I think, is a really good way to put it, because so much of this is about everything. All these people you're observing are living very mundane lives. None of this is, oh, go and work out, like, oh, that person deserves it because X, Y, or Z. It's all trawling through very boring lives, you know, looking for tiny little things you can learn something from. I did one of them earlier today, where it was, oh no, you know who your target is, it's that person, but they're in a hospital and just sleeping all day. You have to look at everyone else's schedules and work out when he's left alone for a minute, and that's when you, so that you can find a time to kill him. And it's all just, you can go through his timeline, and every single thing you uncover is sleep, then he slept some more, then some more sleep, then some more sleep. It really does paint this story of, like, detached observation of unspectacular lives in this big dramatic narrative. The other thing that I think is worth talking about is there is another narrative thread that is told through cutscenes as the years jump forward between each murder. And without saying too much, at some point, your character is witnessed doing a ritual murder and has to capture the person who's witnessed him do the crime, and he basically locks him in a cage. And he's like, can't let you out, because then you'll go tell the police, and they'll stop me murdering people for Zimforth, and the world will end.
Makes sense.
Hope you understand. I don't intend to kill you. I want to be nice to you. I want to give you a good life, but also, I can't let you stop me killing people, or Zimforth will end the world.
Oh, that's Zimforth.
So in between each, like, time it jumps forward a year, you have these little vignettes of a captor who knows he's doing something wrong by holding this man captive in a cage, but does not feel that he should stop doing the murders he is doing, and that is torn between, I am having to keep you trapped, and I know that's not right, but I'm not killing you, I'm not a bad person, I'm not killing you, Zimforth hasn't told me I have to kill you to save the world. And this weird, strange relationship between captor and forced observer. It is a very well-written game that ping-pongs between, like, deeply uncomfortable interactions and detached interactions with things that should not be as mundane as they are, in a way that, like, is very impressive. My two things I would say to be aware of with this game is, first of all, this game wants you to have a degree of ability to hold information in your head. Be that when you're on the video editing timeline, trying to find all the clues that will help you do the ritual for Zimforth, you need to be able to remember what all the criteria that Zimforth is looking for is, so that you don't go into the ritual and go, oh fuck, I forgot to check for that thing. Equally, when you're in doing the ritual, clicking on the things that you're going to remove or chop up or whatever, you need to be able to remember the answers that you saw when you were doing the video editing bit. And that's the thing I struggle with. Initially, my temptation was to think I might need to play this with a notebook, and I did stop at the thought of, am I going to have a notebook that's like, okay, break rib 3 because less than 6 hours sleep, and a list of, like, names and times they did things. Ultimately, I found, like, playing this on my work PC with a screenshot of the ritual screen captured and on my other monitor was enough that, like, if I didn't have to hold one in my head, I could reference the other and sort of do it okay. But if you struggle with remembering what you need to check for and then remembering the answers when you're inputting it, you might struggle a bit with this. The other thing I will say is I haven't quite finished this yet, but I am very, very, very curious how they're going to end this game. Because I think this is spoiler-free to say, because this is a concern I had right from the start of the game. Anytime you have a narrative about someone doing violent crime on behalf of a god, it's very easy for the answer to that to be, oh, God wasn't telling them to do that and the world wasn't going to end if they didn't do the murders, they were just mentally ill. Oh, look at the scary mentally ill person doing a bunch of murders because he's mentally ill. And I don't know if that's where they're going or if, you know, they're going to canonically make it that, you know, Zimforth was real and was threatening to end the world, or if they're just going to be very vague about what the reality was. With any narrative touching on these kind of themes, that's always my, like, caution point that I'm kind of concerned about.
Yeah.
And I want to know where they land that. Because it wouldn't be the first time. Like, me and Jane played a escape room board game box maybe a year or two back, that literally that was the premise, was that it turned out like, oh, you were just mentally ill the whole time. Ugh. And it's like, that's not a fun answer
no.
to a thing like this.
And I mean, it's boring. Like, at this point,
yeah.
Like, even leaving aside the stigmatization, which is, you know, obviously a very valid thing, it's such a boring trope. Like, can you not think of anything original other than, oh, turns out they were crazy? Like, come on.
And here's the thing. With this developer and having played, like, El Paso elsewhere, my gut says they're better than that. And that's probably not where this is going to go.
I would be very disappointed if they didn't.
I would be disappointed and surprised if that was where it was going. But yeah. Also, I haven't gotten there, and I feel like if I'm going to say that this game is interesting and worth checking out, I don't yet know whether I would ultimately kind of caveat that.
Yeah.
So bear that possibility in mind and that I don't know the answer to it, but it is a really interesting, unique little game that does a great job of making something that should be very personal and visceral feel very detached and methodical. In a way that serves its narrative very well.
Hmm.
So yeah, that's Life Eater.
Life Eater? I mean, the premise sounds utterly fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very glad that I've checked it out. What about you, Conrad? We'll jump over to you. Well, you've not jumped in with a thing yet.
I've just been playing Balatro, like finding little gaps here and there in
yeah,
my day.
You're
to,
back in.
To fit. Well, it's something that's quick. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's been that or Spelunky, you know, something that I can put 20 minutes into and then forget about for, you know, a period of time while I go do other shit. Something I did want to mention, I played a board game not that
Ooh.
Long ago called Horrified. This is, I think it's published by Ravensburger, and I'm really, really into cooperative board games. I mean, I'm into cooperation, generally speaking, as a mechanic, just for life. But in my games, I love a good cooperative board game. This is... the original one was using movie monsters you know. And I keep forgetting the studio. MGM? Was it MGM that had the movie Monsters?
The Dark Universe.
Well, yeah, that was what they were going to base the Dark Universe on.
The Dark Universe. The Dark Universe.
And so the first one they came out with had all, you know, Dracula, werewolf, I think Invisible Man, that sort of thing. The one that we wound up getting as a gift from a friend is the American Monsters version, and it's all cryptids from North America.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's...
Chupacabra.
Yep, the chupacabra's in there.
Jersey Devil.
The Jersey Devil's in
the
there,
the Man Moth.
Yep, you're correct.
Have they got...
Any more guesses?
Rake the Carver. That's a more obscure one, that one.
Nope, not in this set.
Yeah. No one gives the rake its props. I know any other? Well, there's the Sasquatch, obviously. Yeah,
we go with Bigfoot here, but yep, that's in there. There's two more, and they are a little more obscure. It's the Ozark Howler and the Badlands Banshee.
Ooh, I've never gotten them.
Nah. Came with nice little models. And so I painted all of them up, and they look neat. And you have a town, and you can play against up to, like, four of these monsters. I'm sure you could try to do it with six, but it would be impossible to win. And each turn, you get to perform the actions of one of your investigators, moving around the board, collecting items that are, you know, used either to defend yourself or to resolve the goal required to eliminate a specific cryptid from the game. The goal is to neutralize all of them. And then after an investigator takes a turn, the monsters take a turn, and they have some rules about where they move in relation to investigators. And then it'll also spawn just citizens in the environment. And that's another wrinkle now, that you have to make sure that the citizens can get to the place that they're going to be safe before they get hunted down and killed by the monsters. And so it's just a lot of managing a bunch of different elements at once and trying to prioritize. It's pretty easy when you only have two monsters to deal with, we've found. But then once you kick it up to three, I'm expecting, we haven't gotten there yet. I think that'll be our next run, but I'm expecting it to be quite a bit more challenging. But it's just a really good, simple little co-op game. Some of these get overcomplicated with mechanics, or you just feel powerless, even though you have all of these people working together. Some of these co-op games can really, like, bury you. But this one seems to have a good balance in terms of offering you a difficulty that is approachable while still providing something of a challenge. I'm into it. I don't think it's made anymore. I think the only one that's, like, in print of this series is Greek Monsters. But hey, if you like playing Hades, maybe you'd be into that. But it's a pretty well-balanced game, great components. I'm a fan. It's on Tabletop Simulator too, if you want to check it out.
Oh, cool. The name of it again is
Horrified. Yeah.
I can give a recommendation of a board game that is similar, that is in print currently. That might be worth folks checking out if they can't find Horrify. There's one called Final Girl.
Oh, sure. I've heard of that.
Yeah, which is very similar premise. It's you've got your classic horror movie monsters just sort of legally distinct done. So you've got your Freddy Krueger's, your Alien, your whatever horror movie you're trying to do. Spawn in your various monsters, pick what actions you're going to do, try and get the civilians to safety without dying or the fear going up too high. Very similar kind of premise. I love the packaging on it. All of the little boxes for, like, adding another horror movie spoof into your collection is like a little VHS box. It's a series of VHS boxes. And then you can mix and match them. So you can have, like, a setting from one horror thing, but you put a different horror creature in it, and now that's going on.
Somebody made a mod for Horrified. Because, as I say, the original one was Movie Monsters from the, you know, 30s and 40s. And they made rules to adapt more modern movie monsters up through the present day. And I think they call that mod Terrified. It's also on Board Game Geek, or it's on Board Game Geek and on Tabletop Simulator. So you could check that out too if you're interested.
Nice.
Yeah.
What about you, Steph? What have you been playing this week?
Why is one of the most famous artist depictions of the Jersey Devil wearing little booties?
That's a great question.
Has he got little... They look like little sandals.
Those hooves get cold.
Maybe people saw him and he was wearing booties at the time.
I'm not one to judge. I'm not one to judge. If the Jersey Devil wants to wear little booties, go for it. I just got a message from someone telling me something they did last night. But I don't think I can mention what political party they're a member of, for which city. But apparently the threesome was quite good. Anyway, moving on. I played, what else did I play? I played Princess Peach Showtime some more. I'm actually posting the review pretty soon after we're done recording here, so that will be up before. It's mediocre. I've played it enough, and I'm like, you know what? It's got nothing to show for itself. It doesn't do much, and I'm bored.
It's got good moments with a lot of in between.
Yeah, and there's no... barely any replay value with how drawn out each level is.
You don't want to slowly redo the whole level, not being able to button mash through dialogue or skip cutscenes in order to try and find that one collectible you missed.
Yeah, I want
And then you miss it a second time and then have to replay the whole level again to try one more time.
Right? There's nothing like having to sit through that twice for one item. You don't even really need to complete the actual game. Yeah, it's really worth getting that item to just sit through unvoiced dialogue that doesn't even really have sound effects attached to it. It's just quiet text and these little sequences, and every character, like every outfit that Peach puts on, has like one main ability and that's it. And they don't even implement the gimmick in imaginative ways. You know, Cowboy Peach has a lasso. She lassos stuff with it. That's it. And especially coming off the back of Mario Wonder, it's just disappointing. It feels like their heart's not in it. I think that's the thing that jumps out at me. It looks like it was made by people who just, their hearts weren't in it. They just weren't into doing this, which is a shame. And that's pretty much all I got to say about that. So I'll quickly move on to another game I've been playing, which is a game by WayForward. They gave me a review copy of Rose and Camellia, which is, imagine if Punch-Out was a period drama crossed with an anime, and that's Rose and Camellia. It's Punch-Out, but elegant women slap fighting.
And no one has told me this game exists.
Yeah, it's sort of come out under the radar, I think. It's fine. I think I'd have preferred it if it was a free demo that just had one slap fight. Because even though each opponent will have like different ways to try and psych you out, it is still largely the same thing. The gimmick of playing it on Switch with Joy-Cons is fun. Like, you know, you're waving your own hand to slap. So the idea is, you know, one of you takes a turn to slap, which for the slapper involves getting the hand in position and then trying to slap it before they can react. So you might like jolt your hand a bit but not slap, and then they might flinch, and that's when you slap them. And the same thing happens when it's your turn to avoid a slap, which is just sort of holding a button and shifting the Joy-Con a bit. And the opponents will, you know, have little tells. Like there's one character that she'll hold up a finger before she slaps you, so you know when to dodge. But if she holds up two fingers, you know that when she goes to slap, she'll also slap again with a backhand. So you got to dodge twice. And then if you successfully dodge, you can do a counter slap. And that's basically it. The feints are different, stuff like that, like different clues to watch out for. But overall, it's the same thing. And the story, while I think it needed to be more melodramatic than it is. It's fine. It's this little argument about like this commoner married this rich man who died, and they're slapping over who inherits the house. And it's a fun game, and it's one of those games where the premise is more fun than the game. And that doesn't mean the game's bad. It's just the bulk of the humor comes from me saying what I said about it's Punch-Out, but period drama and slapping. Once you actually play it, you're like, haha, this is funny. And then you're like, and now this is just a very stripped down Punch-Out.
This has made me think of a thing that I feel like is probably quite comparable. There is a arcade cabinet that is fucking great, but that would not work as like an actual game to play at home, because there's not very much ultimately to it beyond the thing that it is, which is, it's an arcade cabinet that has like a fake table at the front of it, and you have like various scenarios you'll be in, and the whole gist of it is that you're trying to like rile people up and then flip the table, and you physically flip the table on the arcade machine to like send everything on the table flying to upend whatever, like, ah, you're at a fancy dinner party, and you've got to wait until everyone's like at peak fanciness, and then you throw the table and everything goes flying. Great premise, not much of an actual game, but it works because you play it for like 10 minutes in an arcade with like a Japanese name you don't know what it translates to, and you go, that was great.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a full game's worth of idea.
I think this is a similar thing. If this were a free game with just like a slap, I'd have loved that. Or even just like put 99 cents and just have like a slappy simulatory thing. As an attempt at a more full game, like, I've run out of steam with it already, and I've only had a few, like, I've done a few levels, but I'm not excited about doing more. I'm not displeased with what I've played. I'm just, I've had that. That was entertaining, thank you. I don't need the other 90% of this game. But I love the idea. And it's nice to see WayForward still plugging away, you know? It was good old Adam Tierney that sent me the code. Adam Tierney, who was paying Malcolm McDowell on Cameo to constantly talk about myself and Conrad's and our mutual friend Jonathan's adopted son, Mitrov, who lived, grew up, got married, died, like, all over the span of a year. It was great.
It was great, yeah.
It was great. So, yeah, that's Rose and Camellia. Great premise. But one of those games where if you've watched the trailer, you've gotten the joke.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's it. Like, I know we've both played another game, but we can't talk about that one yet.
Oh, I got a couple of things I can't talk about quite yet.
I think on one of them, the embargo on saying you have it dropped today. So we can say that we've got another Crab's Treasure, but I don't think we can have an opinion on it yet.
No, we can't. We definitely can't have an opinion on it. But next week we'll have opinions on it.
Yeah, look forward to that.
Yeah, the only other thing I've played that I can talk about is, much like you, Conrad, I'm still playing Balatro in my like little bits of time in between big things that I should be spending time on.
Yeah.
I've gotten real into pumping the difficulty up on certain decks. And getting real specific on, like, I'm trying to hit max difficulty on a couple of the different decks. Specifically, I'm on the penultimate difficulty for the, I think it's called the checkered deck.
Mm-hmm.
The one that's only hearts and spades. It gets rid of clubs and diamonds, but doubles the number of hearts.
I'm on the last stake of spades. That one.
I'm on orange. I think gold is next.
I am also on orange. I'm sorry, you're correct.
I did just go and unlock a really good, because I just love, like, leaning into flushes and making flushes, like, my entire identity. I realized there is a very powerful joker for flushes, that the only way to get it is to complete a run with any deck on any difficulty, never playing a flush at any point during a run. Which I went and used the deck that is all, that takes all the face cards out, and I did all straights.
Okay.
Because straights are pretty easy to reliably get in that deck, because you've just got, like, a much more condensed number of things that can come up. So I did lowest difficulty, all straights, no face cards. Got my new joker that, when it comes up, triples your score if you play a flush.
Mm-hmm.
Or triples your multiplier. And I was like, yes, that is what I need. But beyond that, I've just been trying to chip away at that one particular deck and see if I can get it to gold difficulty.
Yeah, I have been, I had been on that trek with that deck and got frustrated because the orange stake is really, really difficult.
It's a real spike.
It is, yeah. And so I've been moving on to some other decks. I've been playing a lot of the green deck, which really changes up my strategy a lot because a lot of my focus tends to be on getting money for the shop. And because the green deck earns you double the money for leftover hands and gives you a dollar for every discard but eliminates interest, it, you know, completely switches up my approach. And I've had good luck with that. In fact, while we were recording here, I finished I think the green stake run, or you know, so I'm close to orange on that also, and but I like the idea of using the abandoned deck for straights to get that flush joker, but at the same time I don't know if that would save me even on orange stake with the checkered deck. Like, I think there has to be another way. Like, there's something strategically I'm not thinking through to get there.
I very almost completed orange stake on that checkered deck with flushes. I managed to make it to the boss of Anti 8, and I missed it by like less than $1,000, like 1,000 points. It was ridiculously close. I ended up having a deck that was all built around straight flushes. Mm. I had a couple of good early spectral packs that got me the thing where it's like it gets 5 cards out of the hand are just removed from the deck entirely, but you get $20. And I had that a couple of times in a row, and it kept lucking out and removing most of my face cards went within a couple of spectral packs.
Mm.
And then I spec'd as much as I could into turn all of the deck into one suit.
Right.
Get modifier for every time I play that suit, and then go straight flushes rather than just flushes. And that was enough that I almost got over into gold difficulty. So I'm getting there. I'm finding strategies. I'm seeing stuff that's working. The other thing for the orange difficulty that didn't twig with me for a long time is that at a certain point you stop getting rewarded for discards.
Yeah.
With money.
Yeah.
And realizing like it's much better to use up all of your discards in such a way that you can single round win the hand and get more money for fewer played hands. That took me way too long to catch up.
And that's always sort of been my approach to it, because like if you use 2 discards but save a hand, you're still breaking even.
Yes.
You know?
But like that maths had worked in my head, but I hadn't realized it swayed even more than that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's everything I've played. Have either of you played anything else?
That's it for me.
Yeah, that's it for the stuff I can talk about.
Well, in that case, we got a couple of other bits we can talk about. Let's, where do we start? There's an Apex Legends tournament happening in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, mate, they can cross-promote with the WWE.
Yeah.
They can all bathe in the blood money.
Yeah. You know, people have understandably been concerned, going, hey, you're choosing to host this tournament in a country where some of your players might not feel safe to come and attend the tournament, either as a competitor or as a viewer.
Some of them may not be fucking allowed. Like, let's...
Yeah.
Like, this is something... This is one of the most disgusting parts about, like, when the WWE... Like, because they still go there. And one of the most disgusting things about WWE doing their Saudi shows is one of their performers, Sami Zayn, is not allowed in the fucking country. They will, like, Saudi Arabia have said, like, do not bring him. And, like, his friend Kevin Owens will never perform there, like, because, like, solidarity. But, frankly, I don't know how any performer can do it.
Saudi Arabia would argue, you know, you're welcome to come, just don't display outwardly your identity being what it is, and it won't be a problem.
I should point out that they don't want Sami Zayn because of his Syrian descent.
Fun.
yeah, that one's good old-fashioned family racism. But yes, obviously, lots of other isms as well.
Exactly. But, you know, understandably, people have been a bit upset, you know, particularly given that it's Apex Legends, which is, you know, a game that has many playable LGBTQ plus characters.
Yeah, will they be allowed to pick those ones?
So, the story here is...
What about the women characters who are showing skin? Will they need to wear, like, full coveralls like the women wrestlers who were graciously allowed to have one wrestling match at Saudi Arabia?
All this preamble is required because the way I kept seeing this story reported, and I had several people, like, bring it to me as a good news story, was... Respawn has told fans that they won't be blocking, you know, characters and cosmetics from being played during the tournament. You know, you can play as the LGBT character or use the Pride skin while taking part in a tournament in Saudi Arabia.
Because that's the
it's
thing
a win
that matters.
For diversity.
May I ask a question? Because I've not followed that story. So this is going to be pure guesswork. Also, apologies for being so animated and shouty. This really pisses me off. Obviously, like, everything about that whole regime pisses me off. But, you know, having watched WWE completely sell out and listening to their shit excuses, which is my question. Has anyone from Respawn or EA tried the line that it's okay that they're going to Saudi Arabia because they're bringing progress? Because they're helping Saudi Arabia to modernize and become a better culture that's more open? Because that's what WWE constantly, they're constantly doing the whole we're changing it from within shit.
I get it. They're teaching them how to do performative displays of equality and in order to not have to do it themselves. Because that is absolutely the way of liberal democracies.
Yeah, and it's certainly the Saudi EA way.
Hey.
I can tell you they haven't made a statement like that because I can read you the entirety of their statement, which at no point addresses, you know, the real world people who cannot come and attend this tournament because it's being hosted in Saudi Arabia. Here is the full statement. We are not changing the game. All Legends will be playable. No Apex Legends content, legend or cosmetic, will be restricted at the EWC event.
Very brave, doing nothing. We're doing nothing and we're very brave.
Laura, in Saudi Arabia, the fictional characters of Apex Legends have more human rights than you and I.
Well, we're lower
on the totem pole than fictional characters now. Fuck me.
So yeah, that's happening. Cool, great that your pride skins and whatever are allowed, but it doesn't fundamentally change the problem. Stop fucking allowing Saudi Arabia to launder their image through hosting media events.
Also, it should be pointed out that what Respawn says before they get there and what will happen are two very different fucking things.
Mm-hmm. Respawn can say, we will not prevent anyone from using those characters or skins. If you're someone at that event, you might choose not to use those characters or skins to not get on the radar of the government of the country you are in.
Basically, Respawn can say, we're allowing all of this. But if the Saudi government doesn't allow it, then... they don't allow it. And I suppose that's how Respawn wants to get out of it. But the thing is, you can't get out of it because as soon as they've done that, you are openly selling yourself out and your
values
fucking
are gone.
Game out. I mean, not that they had fucking values.
No.
Like, they've sold those out.
They're
just
professed
going.
Values. It's a clear demonstration that you do not believe the things that you will say to us to make us feel comfortable buying your products.
Yeah. They've exposed themselves as, like, more hollow than I could have even guessed. And that, to sink lower than my estimation, is fucking low. That's fucking subterranean. Still?
Yeah.
Still.
Another quick story we've got this week, and this is just a thing I appreciate because it was my biggest problem with Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Steph, did you ever have a point in Final Fantasy VII Rebirth where you lost or almost lost a lot of progress because you chose an option in a menu after losing a fight that said something like restart from past checkpoint, and you assumed that would be just before the fight, but it was actually like 2 hours ago.
No,
did you not encounter this issue?
Laura, you would have known about it because I would have shouted. You'd have got a message.
I experienced this, and so did a bunch of other people, because there is a really confusing menu that Final Fantasy VII Rebirth had when you lose a battle. And it specifically, you know when you sometimes are like, I'm going off to go do a dungeon, and it's like, are you sure you're ready to go and do this?
Yeah.
In those events, sometimes when you die in a battle, it will give you a series of very similar sounding descriptions, and one of them was like, restart from checkpoint.
Right.
And you would assume that would be your last autosave.
Which, like all video games. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it means like when you said, are you ready to start this whole series of possibly 2 hours of dungeon? And the problem is, there is a way to avoid losing that content, which is you very quickly realize, go to load, find your autosave, which is 2 hours ahead, load that autosave. But if you don't instantly realize what's happened and you accidentally like walk around trying to work out what you've done and like another autosave pops, you've just lost that 2 hours of progress.
Fucking hell. Yeah, because I remember those moments of like, are you sure you want to, etc. And yeah, they last ages.
Yeah, so I experienced this thankfully worked out I could load my autosave. I saw Patrick Klepek fell foul of this didn't realize that autosave could be used to recover it and lost like hours of progress. That has been fixed in the new patch for the game. They've reworded all of the retry from blank prompts so that it's much clearer if you're about to reload a save that's 2 hours ago and not the autosave you think you're loading from like just before this fight.
That would have fucking destroyed me.
It only happened to me once, and once it happened and I thankfully worked out how to dodge it, it wasn't a big problem. But it's such a badly written menu, and yeah, I'm glad that's been updated. We got a nice story here that comes out of a bad story. Nintendo recently shut off the online servers for the 3DS and the Wii U, so you can't, you know, go online on those systems anymore. Terrible for preservation, etc. Mm-hmm. Except you can! People have made a new, basically a fake version of Nintendo's online servers that you can continue to play 3DS and Wii U games online. It's called Pretendo.
I'm so happy to see this. On the one hand, I hate that we have to do this, but I love it. It's a symbol of hope when people can come together as a community and address a problem and make other people's lives better.
So first, I'll start with the entry bit and then where it gets, in my opinion, even better. So if you have a hacked Wii U or 3DS, this has been available for a little while. They've had this service available that you could just connect to this rather than the regular Nintendo network. And you have like a new friends list and all that stuff. Because you're not connecting to Nintendo servers, so you're creating a new set of friends lists and whatever. But it brings back functionality for stuff like Miiverse that didn't work anymore, and like brings all that stuff back and lets you play your online games. The thing that's cooler is apparently the people who make Pretendo have been sat on this for a couple of months, knowing that they could do something better and not announcing it, so that Nintendo couldn't issue a patch to stop them before the servers went down. They were like, look, we know what date Nintendo's last ever patch for those systems will be, after which they can never patch it again. We'll just keep quiet.
Beautiful. It's what we always say on this show, like, keep it on the down low.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they've not managed to do this for 3DS yet, but for Wii U, you don't even have to have a hacked system. You can just change your DNS address and connect to this new alternate version of the Nintendo network.
Nyak, nyak, nyak.
They found a DNS exploit that just allows them to go, just change this one little number, and it acts as if you're still on Nintendo's network.
Lovely.
That's great. Well done, people, keeping fucking quiet about the fact they found a cool exploit.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one, and there's, you know, it's not much of a news story, but I think it's worth noting. We're getting real close to Hades 2 happening.
Oh, God. God, when is that?
Well, we know it's coming this summer, but There is a technical test happening that you can go on Steam right now and register your interest in to be one of the first people that gets access to Hades 2, and that is, like, very shortly happening. Ooh. And then very soon after, the game will be going into early access. So if you're desperate to play it, like, the earliest possible second, you can go, like, click a button in Steam on Hades 2's page to maybe get lucky and get to do that. But it seems like early access Hades 2 is going to be probably within, my gut says by June, like by the time of Summer Games Fest and all that stuff happening, we're probably looking at Hades 2 early access. So yeah, Hades 2 is what is closer than I expected it to be. It's going to be real soon.
That's cool.
Yeah, there we go. I think that's it.
Yeah.
We've done it.
Well, we have. Yeah. We've done it. And Laura, you've done it, which is plural for it, which means you've done lots of things. And you should tell people, I reckon.
I've done lots of things, and I will tell people.
Yeah.
You can find all the stuff I've done at Laura K Buzz pretty much everywhere on the internet. I've got that good unified branding. Laura K Buzz on Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, TikTok, Patreon. That's the one that pays the bills. Blue Sky, Mastodon, all the places. Find me at Laura K Buzz. I will be at the GA Conf Game Accessibility Conference next week, on Monday and Tuesday. So if you're not attending in person, you can watch all of the talks from that live online, live streamed with things like sign language interpreter support available. I'll be in the Discord chatting along from the event while people are doing their talks. So if you want to learn a bunch of stuff about accessibility and also see me in the chat talking about accessibility, come check out GA Conf next week. What about you, Conrad? Where are you on the internet?
Oh, you can find me at Conrad Zimmerman on Instagram and Blue Sky, and you can hang out with me on Twitch, where I've mostly just been playing a bunch of Spelunky 2, but they've been having some really, like, entertaining runs also. So if you want to, like, come see somebody die shamefully, that's a place to do it. You can buy Anti-Capitalist Propaganda and Jimquisition merchandise at mercenarycreative.com. And everything that I do online gets supported through Patreon at patreon.com/fistshark. And you know who else has a Patreon? Stephanie Sterling.
That's correct. Patreon.com/Jimquisition, which supports all of the stuff. My next wrestling date is confirmed for May 9th. I will be back in Leeds for True Grit Wrestling. So if you look that up, that'll be at the Left Bank venue. Leeds, May 9th, True Grit Wrestling. We also have the July 8th Pride of the Ring show in Blackpool with PCW. There are other dates currently unannounced. Hopefully, we're close to being able to talk a little bit about a game I'm writing for. It's a new IP, but there's some good pedigree there, and it's very exciting. And more Vampire Survivors stuff. I will be contributing to the Vampire Survivors Adventures mode, and we'll have some more stuff coming. Very exciting stuff. Other than that, thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.